Welcome to episode 16 of the GGT podcast. I'm your host, Dan Larry, and today I have two of my favorite people from the world of health and fitness, David and Rachel Godfrey. David is an author, international speaker, peak performance coach, and specialist in emotional and behavioral change. He has over 15 years' experience helping people overcome a variety of conditions, including depression, chronic fatigue syndrome, disordered and compulsive eating, phobias, and addiction. Rachel is regarded as one of the world's leading female consultants and an international influencer on female health and fitness. Specializing in fat loss and behavioral change, Rachel is a former physio and oxygen cover girl with 14 years experience training busy, driven, high-performing women. Rachel and David currently reside in the UAE with their two young children. Chase Life Consulting is a global business serving clients from all over the world. They have an unrivaled track record for helping people overcome binge and emotional eating, stress, and overwhelm. This is a great episode. Sit back. I hope you enjoy this one. There's some great information here for anyone who struggles with mastering the emotional side of food. All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is the first duo interview I've done, and I've been very generous in the intro, as always, doing a significant coverage of your respective careers. So why don't we start with how you guys came to be working together?
Well, do you want to answer this one, or shall I? Well, when I met David in 2015, I had got to a stage in my career where I was looking for more, having spent at that stage, certainly 11, 12 years in the fitness industry. I was really looking at how to improve the service that I was offering clients. And one of the trends that I had noticed was this big problem with binge and emotional eating, or mindless eating, or nighttime eating, whatever people like to call it, this compulsive eating. And I had started at that stage to look into things like NLP, looking at more mindset stuff. And then I met David, and not only did I find a husband, but I also found a business partner as well, because David had already spent 15 years of his career actually working in the field of emotional and behavioral change. So that's essentially how Chase Life was born and how it started, when we met.
All right, so Rach, you've obviously got a huge background in fitness and physique-based sports that sort of led you to that point. David, how did you get involved in all this behavioral change type training relative to what people are looking at from a fitness and physique transformation side of things?
So they'd always both been massive loves of mine. I got obsessed with mindset stuff from quite an early age, initially through sport. I think the first book I ever read or thing I was exposed to, I was about probably 14 at the time, looking into sports psychology. And it kind of grew from there. From there, I think I started looking into hypnosis and then meditation. And then I discovered NLP and hypnotherapy and all these other things like acceptance and commitment therapy and EFT and all of these other things. Just started kind of just exploring more and more and more and studying more and more courses and so forth. And at some point, it grew to a point where I realized, one, I love this, and two, I'm really good at it, and I know I can help people. And that's when I started doing it professionally. Now, at the time, also because I've done so many sports, loved fitness too. At the time, I was a personal trainer. That was kind of my bread and butter, so to speak. And then I started working professionally in terms of my title at the time, it was NLP master, hypnotherapist, life coach. But as with all of these things, right, it's like, you could compare physio, osteos, and chiros. And it's like, well, ultimately it comes down to the practitioner and what they've studied in their personal experience. And so anyway, at the time I was working with a lot of people who struggled with things like depression, chronic anxiety, chronic fatigue. and at the same time as personal training. And so at the time, I loved what I did with the mindset stuff, but business-wise, it was trickier because when you're good with that stuff, your clients don't stick around for long. Right? It's not like, you know, some people are in therapy for years and years and years, and like as the therapist, you have a reliable income because your clients come to you every week. But if you help people overcome their issues quickly, then they resolve their issues and then they go away. And it's like, great, thanks, I've resolved the issue. So there was this just constant turnover of clients, and it was just unreliable, purely financially. So whereas personal training is kind of the opposite. If you're good as a personal trainer, then your clients stick around and you have a reliable client base. So I was doing the two together side by side for quite a long time. And then I met Rachel, and obviously Rachel had nailed the business side of things, and knew how to market. And so yeah, as Rachel said, it was kind of
match made in heaven.
Exactly, yeah. Husband and wife and business partners.
Airtight business model, that one. meet someone who's a good wife and also knows how to do your marketing. So the service that you guys provide now, it's essentially in the area of helping people improve their emotional fitness. Tell us a little bit more about that. So for anyone who's listening, who's never heard of that term, give us a bit of depth on what that means and how it helps people.
Yeah, it's a term that we use from time to time. It's kind of a tricky blanket description, I guess, but it's basically helping somebody to create the emotional stability for them to be consistent with whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. So, you know, people have these body goals, fitness goals, performance goals, but they're supposedly getting in their own way. Right? They end up binge eating or emotional eating, or, you know, they're motivated for a couple of weeks and then they lose motivation, et cetera, et cetera. And so what is it that's causing those problems? If you look at the 99%, throwing out a random statistic, but you know, I'm sure you'd agree, of people who don't get the result that they are after in a fitness goal or a body transformation goal, it's not because of a lack of strategy. Right? It's not because of a lack of knowledge or insights in terms of fitness or nutrition. It's purely application. They're just not being consistent. They're allowing other things to get in the way. And that is purely an emotional thing, right? Because we make decisions for emotional reasons. We make decisions for emotional reasons first, and then we justify them with logic later. So it's about helping people to overcome the emotional blockages, the internal conflicts and so forth that are contributing to all of that self-sabotage and on the wagon, off the wagon, or just inconsistency.
Cool. So it's kind of like the game beyond the game.
Yeah. It's the hidden foundation that most people have no idea about, right? It's, you know, most people in different areas of life obsess over the strategy. In fitness, people obsess over diet and nutrition. In business, people obsess over, you know, funnels and, you know, marketing copy and, you know, Facebook ads or whatever the latest thing is. And in relationships, it's like pickup lines or, you know, how do you change your profile on a dating app? And what do you say when you're texting somebody back? And, you know, people obsess over the external strategy, but they didn't realize that the core thing that drives the whole process is your mindset, your emotions, and so forth. And it's kind of it's the iceberg analogy, right? It's the 90% that's underwater.
But people don't really like to talk about emotional fitness because it's very hard to measure. And this is why people like to talk about things like tracking calories and macros as an example, because it's very easy to, like, you know, put your little numbers in an app and you know, your app spits out whether you've been good or bad that day and whether you've been successful or not that day. Whereas when we're looking at emotional fitness, we're talking about emotions here. Like, that's not something that you can measure. It's something that you have to feel. And so that can be quite challenging for people to, first of all, come to terms with. They think that it's very woo-woo, which it is far from woo-woo. Like, anybody who knows me, I am like the most far from woo-woo person you can get. But this has been certainly a learning experience for me as a former perfectionist and a workaholic, you know, emotional fitness was something that I very much had to work on as part of my journey, especially, you know, I'm so grateful that I got to do this work before becoming a mother, because I tell you, there's no other time in life, I think, that when you need emotional fitness the most is when you become a parent. When you've got, you know, I've now got two children, two very young children to look after. I've got a business to run. You know, I still want to train. I still want to look good. I still want to have a healthy physique and a healthy body. And there is no way I would be able to manage what I manage now in terms of time management, looking after the babies, running the business, etc., unless I had that emotional fitness that goes on behind it. Because children in particular, as you all know, Dan, they can push your buttons and they can push you emotionally. And if you are not ready for that, you know, it can be very difficult.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's always struck me, and this is a line of discussion that's come up a few times on this podcast. The sort of the more I go through life, the more I see all of these pursuits, whether it be fitness, whether it be business, whether it be relationships, they're really just vehicles for self-development, aren't they? Like the actual strategy and the mechanics of, you know, how do you get leaner, or how do you get stronger, or how do you grow a business? The strategies are just that. And unless you're developing as a person, deploying those strategies and keeping them where they need to be is almost impossible. And it's, you know, the fitness side of it, personally, I've always found fitness really, really easy. You know, I grew up in a household where there were good behaviors to model, always played sport. And I suppose a lot of my identity through my teenage years was built around being someone who played sport. So translating that into being, you know, fit as an adult has been very, very easy. And at times I've struggled a little bit to see why people make it so hard for themselves. But I'm sure my wife, Alana, won't mind me mentioning that she's done your program, and just seeing the sort of work she did with you guys and the content and how it applies in other contexts, it sort of helped answer a few questions for me. And I suppose the area where I've been able to develop a better understanding of why people struggle with the fitness stuff for me has been business. And if I think back to how much I've had to develop as a person to be successful in business, and I look at the gap from where I started to where I am now, and the amount of skills I had to learn and the amount of adjustments I had to make to my own personality, you know, so that I wasn't doing things that were destructive in business, and still the amount of things I've still got to learn, I start to get a lot more of an idea around why people struggle to make fitness such a constant. It's a continual theme that these things are really just a vehicle for self-development.
Yeah, and you know, it's important to help people understand that. If they are struggling, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with them as a person. It's just they've unconsciously, without even realizing it, learned some patterns of thought and patterns of emotion and patterns of behavior that are just not helpful and not useful. They've learned, I often describe it as a skill set, right? So low self-worth, overanalyzing, perfectionism, people-pleasing, chronic worry, these are skills. They're not particularly useful skills. They create a lot of stress and overwhelm, but fundamentally they're skills in the sense that there's a very clear process, there's a very clear structure for how you create that emotion or that behavior. And so things like confidence, self-worth, calmness, purpose and passion, energy, these also have a very clear strategy. So we're just swapping one skill set for another. There's nothing fundamentally flawed or broken with people. It's just that people grow up in different environments and different circumstances, and they're exposed to different conditioning forces throughout life. Every day, like, this stuff is going on all the time, unconsciously, that leads people to struggle with things like just not feeling good enough, or to develop these habits for how to be successful, whatever they see success as, right? So they develop perhaps perfectionism traits, and if they're willing to push hard and suffer through, they can achieve a certain degree of success up to a certain plateau until the amount of stress is just reaches a threshold they can't grow beyond. But if they have a high tolerance for pain and they can push themselves hard, they can do actually quite well, at least externally well, in terms of climbing the corporate ladder and, you know, earning a decent income and so forth. They can do quite well using strategies like that, but it has a lot of downsides, and it's but they become addicted to it or fearful of letting go of it because they don't know how to be productive. They don't know how to produce a high level of output without flogging the shit out of themselves and without using pain as the primary driving force. But it's completely unsustainable. So there are all these like little things that are going on unconsciously, and it's not their fault. It's just habits that they've developed along the way. So we just need to teach them a new way of doing things.
So David's just pretty much told you my story.
I've got to interrupt, and you know, I always one thing I always did notice about you was how driven you were, and you know, I think a lot about the people I know and the people I spend time with, and I think, okay, what's driving that? Where's that coming from? And so I always found it like a passing interest as part of your personality trait was, okay, why is Rachel so driven? Why you always came across as someone who was out to prove something to the world.
Yeah. And I think it was a double, it was two things. It was, first of all, the perfectionism. So the fear of being judged, and that's exactly what perfectionism is. And part of being driven for me was, some of it was positive, you know, especially being financially driven, it's like being financially rewarded for me equals freedom and choice. Mm. And so there was definitely like that positive pull, but I think, you know, looking back, certainly sort of 10 years ago, 10, 7 to 10 years ago, it was definitely, having to prove something. It was having to prove something to myself because my self-worth was based upon how much I was achieving externally. And this I think started when I was at school. And I think, you know, it's something that I've been brought up with. You know, you perform well at school, you perform well in sports. And this is how like perfectionism was almost congratulated in a way. And this is through no fault of my parents, right? As a parent myself, like I want my children to do well. Mm. And so I saw, you know, how I was being rewarded emotionally when I did well, when I did well at school, when I did well at sport. And that then came through to business life as well, as I always wanted to prove something to myself. And I always wanted to prove to other people that I could do it, especially being in the fitness industry. It's a very male dominated industry. You know, when I started in the fitness industry, I was one of very few trainers. And so that was definitely an external driver for me. It was kind of like, well, fuck you, like I'll show you sort of thing. Which, you know, it can be like motivating to a certain extent. But as David said, you know, I achieved all of that through extreme stress and perfectionism in the background, where it was debilitating and it cost relationships. It cost my happiness in a way. And, you know, it's not to say that I was ever unhappy. I was never fundamentally unhappy, but I always felt like something was missing, and that thing that was missing was downtime and actually showing up as who I really was, not who I thought I should be. And I was always showing up as this person who I thought I should be. And it was frankly exhausting. So yeah, it's quite interesting when we, you know, when we kind of look back on the past 10 years, especially like, you know, Dan, you and I have like, we've got 10, 12 years ago, I think we met, and, you know, to see our careers and how they've changed, I certainly had to evolve as a businesswoman to break through that threshold, because I had reached a certain stage where I pushed to that level and I couldn't go beyond that without some personal development. And so, you know, very similar stories, I guess, in a way.
Mm. Yeah, I can't help but be struck by the whole thing there too. You know, you talked about how that was essentially the culture of your household, and there's those high expectations of you, and that sort of mold your identity and your values and how you behave, you know, sometimes to the detriment of having some balance and being able to put those behaviors in their place. And it's funny, you know, like human history is kind of, it's kind of like the history of parents, despite their best intentions, you know, burdening their children with all these things they've got to work out as adults and get over. And a lot of those behaviors you're explaining before, David, like the, you know, the perfectionism, the self-worth, these are obviously behaviors and strategies we learn in those early years in life, right?
Yeah, and we're, to a certain degree, human beings are just predisposed to developing some kind of challenges in this regard for a couple of reasons. So we have a part, a very, very primitive part of the brain, one of the oldest parts of the brain, that is responsible for keeping us alive. And so that part of the brain is always going to look out for danger. It's always going to look out for threats. So that part of the brain is designed to try to predict and protect. So part of that protection mechanism is a desire for acceptance, because human beings evolved in groups. And historically, you know, thousands of years ago, your survival depended on being part of a group. If you were ostracized from the group, then chances are you died. Going it alone in the wild, not a good strategy. So we have this inbuilt desire for acceptance. And that can cause these overreactions and these interpretations as to, oh, I'm being rejected, or I could be rejected, right? So Rachel doing really well at school and getting really good grades. Now she's got this sense of status, and it might be imposed from other people in terms of maybe the teacher says you're the top of the class, or it might just be completely silent inside her own head in terms of I'm the best. But now you've got something to lose. And if I lose that, what are people going to think of me? Are they going to think that, you know, I'm on the decline, I'm on a downward slope? And then you're worrying about other people's opinions and so forth. So we have these mechanisms that to a certain degree are imposed, but I want to emphasize that that doesn't mean that you're doomed to suffer emotionally. It's more that all of us have a personal evolution of more and more and more emotional freedom. It's like the game of life is to discover. So first of all, you don't know what you don't know. And life is going to continue to knock on the door with people and circumstances to reveal to you where you're not yet emotionally free, where you've got some kind of invisible self-imposed barrier. And so the game of life is to discover what that, what the next kind of layer of the onion is, and to dissolve it, to realize that it's just a bunch of bullshit. It's made up stuff. Right? It's just stuff we, you know, we make up. Like, what if I'm not enough? It's like, you know, that kind of question. It's a complete non-question. It's like walking around wondering, what if gravity fails and we all float off into space? It's just a meaningless question that you should just, there's absolutely no purpose or value to asking that question. There's no such thing. But once you start asking the question, then you make a big deal out of it, and then you start just getting in your, and that could have been going on unconsciously since you were six. And then you suddenly realize it, you're like, oh yeah, I don't need to question it. I don't need to question if I'm enough or not enough. It's not even a thing. Yeah. And so actually what really matters is, am I happy? Am I in a good, positive, empowering state? And am I getting the results that I want? And if not, I can change that.
Yeah, I love that model. You know, that hunter-gatherer model of understanding the, you know, the emotional components to survival and fitting into the group, and just realizing that a lot of these thoughts that just pervade our being are really just tied back to that old model that doesn't really serve us anymore.
Yeah, for sure. Doesn't really serve us anymore. And also, like, if you really think about what acceptance it, like when we ourselves obsess over acceptance, you know, whether that manifesting itself in the fear of rejection, the fear of failure, right? Because that's an acceptance thing, right? Because if I fail, I will be looked upon badly by other people. That's a fear of rejection. That's an acceptance thing. Perfectionism as well, right? It's an acceptance thing. If I can get everything perfect and look perfect, then nobody's going to be able to judge and criticize me. So it's all this acceptance stuff. So if we look at, well, acceptance at the end of the day is really acceptance of self. Because if you totally and completely accept who you are as a person, then when somebody else comes along with their opinion, whether it's positive or negative, doesn't really hold any weight. Mm. Not that, you know, you can't feel grateful for when somebody says something nice, and not that you shouldn't stand up for yourself if somebody, you know, attacks you verbally, but it doesn't really hold any sway over how you feel about yourself, the decisions you're going to do that day, make that day, where you're going with your life. It's just irrelevant, really. Why? Because you feel good within yourself. Like, you totally, completely accept yourself and who you are as a human being. So when people are obsessing over acceptance from the outside, really it's just acceptance of self, which is the kind of the core thing.
Yeah, totally. We're going to sort of go down the whole, you know, the paradigm of how this affects people's behaviors around fitness and nutrition and stuff. But, you know, before we do this, this sort of reminds me of a great book I read. Have you read a book called The Way of Men by Jack Donovan? So great book, amazing. And it really helped me understand a lot of parts of myself. And it's essentially explaining a lot of the behaviors that men have to do with that whole, you know, tribal sort of model. And essentially, we still have this conditioning in our society where we have this love of the lovable rogue, you know, the gangster who's really a good guy and he, you know, steals from the rich and gives to the poor or whatever it may be. There's still this part of us that can look upon that character, that good guy who does bad things for the right reason. It's also one of the reasons why, you know, the UFC is so popular and we look up to athletes who are playing violent sports. And it's that whole part of our persona where we subconsciously acknowledge that violent men were necessary, you know. So when we lived in tribes, the violent strong men kept our people safe, and they stopped the violent men from other tribes coming in and, you know, hurting our people and taking our stuff. And so The Way of Men really explains all of that. It explains why, you know, as men, we also have that part of ourself. We have that part that can think about going to that place or consider using strategies which just aren't acceptable in today's society, obviously. But reading that book really helped me understand some of those parts of myself that I used to think, geez, that's, you know, that's a bit dark when I'd have certain thoughts, but just really come to that level of acceptance. And I think it's very different for men to what it is to women. Like these very ancient parts of our brain are focused on very different things to what the female brain is, but definitely helps when you understand that it's just part of the program and part of the old program that you don't even need to use anymore, rather than an inherent flaw with who you are.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's not, obviously our business is very, certainly in the past, has been very female focused, and we do work with guys, you know, I work with guys on a one-on-one basis when they reach out. But it's not something that we talk about a huge amount, actually, are some of the perhaps emotional challenges that guys go through. But one of them is absolutely what you just discussed just now, which is like, where, as a man, where do I fit in today's society? We've got equality. Everybody can achieve the same things. There's no, you know, gender bias in terms of, you know, what you can achieve and what you can do and so forth. But then as a guy, like you said, you've got these inbuilt programs that are, you know, very deep rooted in evolution that are predisposed to aggression, for example, or, you know, and so how do you channel that and what's appropriate? And when I think it's really important that people start learning to nurture and get in touch with masculinity, but in a way that is life enhancing and, you know, serves the greater good and so forth. But how do you do that? And a lot of people, I think, accidentally, with, like, you know, well-meaning, but accidentally can end up squashing that in little boys when they're growing up. Mm. And they squash it, and they squash it, and they suppress it, and that's bad, and that's bad, don't do that, don't do that. And then as a result, it ends up popping out in things. They become addicted to porn, or, you know, they are doing, like, nasty things behind closed doors, and so forth. And it pops out in these places because they don't know how to handle it, and it's just bubbling beneath the surface, and it bubbles, and it bubbles, and then it explodes out. And I think, like you said, like, one of the key things is acceptance. Is, you know, when we look at what the ego is, like, the ego is going to be frightened. The ego is going to want to lash out. And I think there's a real kind of dichotomy in managing emotional state, which is, on the one hand, taking complete ownership for your emotional state, deciding what is the most beneficial emotional state for me to be in right now, and making a genuine full-on commitment to stepping into that, whilst also holding a space where you recognize that the human mind is going to produce these knee-jerk reactions. Mm. It's going to have that fuck you kind of response. Mm. And not to make that bad, not to see that reaction as there's something fundamentally wrong with me and I'm a bad human being, I'm bad as a person, and now I can't accept myself. Mm. So we have to hold space for that, whilst also making a commitment to grow emotionally so that we can manage situations just in a much more effective manner.
Yeah, totally. I think there was a term in the book. It said we need to learn the difference between being a good man and being good at being a man. And so being good at being a man is all those very masculine traits, you know, being aggressive, being, you know, having the potential for using violence as a tool of self-defense or any of these things. Whereas being a good man is about doing good manly things for your community or your family or whatever it may be. I had a situation a while back, a situation of friction. It wasn't so much from my side, but it was someone I was dealing with. And we eventually managed to come to the table, and he said, you know, Dan, he goes, people say you're a good bloke, but I can see beyond that. I can see that you're very, very malicious and blah, 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 blah. And basically the guy had a problem with me. And once he'd said his piece, I said, you know what? You're actually right. A lot of those things you've said is true, but, you know, I choose not to express those. They are part of who I am, that I do have the potential for all that, but
I've lost the sound.
Done. I lost the sound.
Oh, okay. Got me now? Let me know when you can hear me.
I can hear you now. You said, but.
Okay. So where was I? Yeah. I said, all those things are true. You know, I mean, I think anyone who denies that they can be those things is just in denial of what their fundamental nature is. And at the end of the day, this was just someone who I think was bringing their own stuff to the table. They were very hypervigilant around the threat of other men. And I think maybe there was a historical thing there for them. But it was definitely, you know, for me personally, a really interesting situation in that I was able to sit there and go, yeah, all these things you're saying about me are true to an extent, but I'm not, you know, I've got no interest or motivation in expressing them towards this person who was maybe concerned I was going to do that. So, you know, there's the more you learn about this stuff, the more you come to accept that there can be two parts of you that reside within the same body, right?
Yeah, and also I kind of feel like identity is even deeper than that. Mm. So you know, that's the I see identity as this kind of pure infinite possibility. Mm. That we all have. It's just that the mind, as in like the human mind, can convince you of certain things just purely from that fight or flight response kind of place. And once you learn to grow emotionally, once you learn to manage your emotions more consistently in gradually ever increasing challenging situations, then you no longer get triggered by stuff.
Yeah,
it's like when somebody comes up. So, like, the fact that you didn't respond emotionally to this bloke who said this stuff to you is a great indication that you have evolved and grown so much, because how many other people do we know in that same situation who would either go offense or defense? Offense being, fuck you, like, you don't know anything about me, and immediately, why? Because I feel like you're judging me. Or going defense in terms of being a people pleaser, and I desperately want you to like me. Oh, no, I'm not like that. I promise, like, whatever, right? Mm. So either of those reactions is a massively emotional reaction, as opposed to you, who clearly in that moment had a very profound sense of self-acceptance, which is, your opinion matters nothing to me, and not from a place of defensiveness, not from, you know, I give zero fucks, and it's obviously an aggressive thing. It's like, it's genuinely when you totally and completely accept yourself, when somebody else comes along with their opinion, whether positive or negative, it doesn't hold any weight. It doesn't really influence you and how you feel. And so because you've done that work, and I think that's where we do that personal growth and that personal evolution, that starts to reveal more and more our true identity, because we're no longer triggering the fight or flight mechanisms over and over again. A lot of people are walking around in their daily life constantly with their guard up, constantly looking, where's the next threat coming from? Men and women, like, all day, they're living in that state. They're living in low self-worth, perfectionism, people-pleasing, over-analyzing, overthinking, constantly having a chip on their shoulder. There's always like a threat coming from somewhere. And when you have that self-acceptance piece, you learn to manage your emotions, your mindset from the inside, all of those barriers start to dissolve, and now you're able to just be and be... just take things in your stride and no longer be triggered all the time. So I think that's kind of like not being suckered into believing that if you do have short-term reactions like that, that defines you and who you are as a person.
Yeah, I really like what you said there about, your identity having an infinite bandwidth of possibilities. And it's a great way to describe it, I think. So in the context of most of the work you do, and I think that this is gonna, resonate with a lot of people, because I mean I have a good understanding of what you guys do, and I look at a lot of my own clients, and I just see them as being great clients for you guys, and in fact we've recommended your work to a number of our clients. We sort of acknowledge that it's probably the thing they need more. Obviously. Exercising with us on a daily basis is great and good for them, but we, as the facilitators of the exercise piece, we acknowledge and recognize it's probably not the exercise or lack thereof that is going to solve their problems. What are some of the common things you guys are seeing and some of the common problems you're helping people with?
Well, I think that one of the primary things that particularly ladies come to us with is binge and emotional eating. Now, people can label it however they want: binge and emotional eating, mindless eating, grazing, snacking, bedtime eating, whatever it is, like, going through the cupboard with a spoon, eating dry cereal, et cetera, et cetera. It's basically, are you eating through compulsion or choice? If you are eating through compulsion, this is generally certainly an area that we specialize in. But that's not to say that we don't work on other things as well. So as an example, why would somebody struggle with binge and emotional eating? And a lot of our clients are busy, driven, successful women. They've got, busy lives, busy businesses, often mothers. And so there's always a lot going on. And so there's quite a few reasons why, people binge and emotionally eat. A lot of it has got nothing to do with diet and exercise. And yet that is where they're searching for the solutions, is to track their food in with a little bit more detail, to know a little bit more about, what the molecular structure of protein is, count their fucking grains of rice, eat out of Tupperware, et cetera, et cetera. That is all of these behaviors, trying to control your relationship with food using behaviors like this, just make the problem even worse. Mm. So this is an area that we specialize in. In addition to stress and overwhelm, and I think sometimes the two definitely go hand in hand, because when you're busy, stressed, and overwhelmed, food can be an emotional release for you, and it's always there. and it can give you a sense of peace. It allows you to switch off by doing something, because this is something else that a lot of our ladies struggle with, is this feeling of only being worthy when they're doing something, and busy being busy, or being the human doing. So at least when they're eating, they're doing something. So this is the kind of area in which we work, and you know, there are many other aspects to it, but the answer and the solution to these things is not in diet and exercise. Sure, food plays a part, you know, we have to make sure that physical hunger is taken care of, but that's not where the solutions do lie.
Yeah. So there's almost like a momentum that people get into, and the eating gets caught up and brought along with that momentum, or that pressure for momentum that they're putting on themselves.
Definitely. And I think, you know, food is, I think some of the traits that a lot of our clients have is this issue about control and trust. So one of the things that they want to control even more and more is their food, because if they can't control other environments, at least that they can control their food. And so when they control their food with this very precise degree, actually they have no control, because David's got this really good analogy about this tightrope analogy, and it's so true. David,
is this the tightrope with spiders on it?
Oh, don't even go there, because so Danny, you used to do in Bondi, like, you know my thing with spiders, so we're not even going to go there right now, but anyway. Yes.
For the listeners, yeah. Rachel is terrified of spiders.
So my tightrope analogy is just a way that I like to describe the psychological impact of counting calories, and the perfectionism that it breeds, and the loss of control that it leads to. So what I often say to people is that the greater the degree of control that you believe you need to have, then the greater the fear of losing control. And what counting calories teaches people is that you have zero margin for error, and it's got to be precise all the time, every day. Do not go over by one calorie. And so the analogy being is that if you imagine having to walk across a plank, and it's at ground level, it's literally on the ground, and it's, let's say, 2 meter plank, you've got to walk from one end to the other, right? How do you feel whilst you're walking across the plank? Like, how confident are you that you can walk to the other end of the plank without falling off? Right? It's dead easy. You just put one foot in front of the other, you just look at the other end, and then you're done. But if we put that exact same plank between two skyscrapers, same distance, it's nice and sturdy, it's not going to go anywhere, but now how do you feel? Right? When you're at ground level, what's the worst that can happen? If you happen to momentarily lose your balance, you briefly step off onto the grass and then you get back on the plank again. What's the worst that can happen when you briefly, momentarily lose your balance at skyscraper level? You plummet to your death. Right? That's kind of how it feels to people when they're counting calories to these minuscule degrees, is that instead of focusing on the outcome and what they can do instead of what they can't do, and just on the next step and just having a relaxed mindset about it all, now there's this monumental fear of losing control, this like almost like paralysis by analysis, and it's like, oh my god, don't go over, and do not eat chocolate at any cost, and you can't do this and you can't do that, and oh my god, ugh. Like, there's all this like stuff that they're just obsessing over and dwelling over, and all of that pressure builds and it pops out somewhere. So yeah, that's kind of like my way of explaining.
And it's a challenge, isn't it? Because, I mean, we've got a fitness industry now, which is, I think, probably the most science savvy I've seen in the industry in my time in it. And, you know, where once upon a time, personal trainers were probably more just showing people the practices, the daily practices that work for them. We've certainly gone more towards this culture where it's got to be evidence-based. And obviously the big thing in it, in the evidence-based movement, is that, you know, tracking calories works, and people have got to be landing in their protein target and got to be landing in their calorie target. So this obviously works to a degree, and it definitely has validity. but we've got to develop some nuance with this, like we do most complicated topics, around how much focus do we put on the whole calorie target versus focus on teaching people positive behaviors that are going to serve them.
Yeah,
exactly that.
So I think one of the things for me to emphasize is that what we do and what we're saying, none of it flies in the face of science.
Yeah.
We are not contradicting any of it. We're saying absolutely the science matters. Absolutely, we need both. Like if we want fat loss, we need both a calorie deficit and we need a healthy metabolism and, you know, we need hormones functioning adequately and so on, so that, you know, the right nutrients goes in the right places and blah, 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 right? So we need both of those. So, and we're not denying any of that. But what we're questioning is, what is your methodology for influencing calories, for influencing macros? And we would argue that there is a significantly more effective way of influencing those things without having to track things to minuscule degrees and feel like you've got no room for error and now you're stuck between a rock and a hard place and everything's fear-based and perfectionism-based and it's this all or nothing mindset. Because what ends up happening is people are all or nothing. They're all on and then they're all off because they can't keep it up.
And so, the truth is that we're very emotional beings as humans and we need, this is where the art of coaching comes in.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people actually hide behind the science and actually science, and again, science is fantastic, science is great. But it also gives people a really good way to hide in the science and say, no, this is the only way of doing things because it's proven in science. Well, what happened to the art of coaching and bridging that gap between science and behavior and human behavior and you know, the psychology of eating and the psychology of your clients? Now, there are some clients, like I don't actually track my calories and macros with any of my clients unless they are in a weight category. So when I was training MMA fighters and they were having to hit weight categories, or if somebody's competing and they're in their final couple of weeks of prep, et cetera, et cetera. Like that's fine. Like, but generally speaking, I feel with my 15 years experience in industry, especially training women, counting calories and tracking in macros is complete overkill for the general population to get a really good, sustainable body transformation moving, and to keep that moving forward. You do not need to be counting your grains of rice. You do not need to be eating out of Tupperware. We need to be teaching people how to navigate the gray areas of life. What happens when you're traveling? What happens when you turn up to a conference and they've only got cheese sandwiches there? What are you going to do? Like not eat, or are you going to binge? Because this is what's happening at the moment.
Or get your weighing scales out.
Or get your weighing scales. Like over my dead body, am I going to a restaurant with my scales? Forget it. Like, and this is what we have to teach, is this balancing, this is the art of coaching between balancing the science and the psychology of it and the behavior that goes on behind it. And it's meshing those two worlds together. And it is, it takes an experienced coach to do that. And look, we've all been there. I've told my clients in the past many, many years ago to track calories and macros. I've counted my calories and macros in the past many years ago, not for very long, because quite frankly, it was deathly boring, bored the shit out of me, and is not something that I could stick to. So people say that it gives you freedom. No, it doesn't give you freedom, because what happens if I was to take your app off you? Then you would still be worried about what you were eating. So there's definitely an art of coaching and an art of science that goes on behind this. And you know what, as a trainer, I think also it's an evolution where you also have to go through these evolutions yourself. And this is the difference between, I guess, you know, a newbie coach and somebody who's got 15 years of experience.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, from where I sit, it's a conversation, or the conversations I have where I'm at odds with another coach will be when they've got 3 to 5 years experience. And it's, they have these very rigid belief structures, very black and white. And they're sort of coming at it from a position of, this is how you do it. And it's, you know, when you have the benefit of hindsight and experience, you're like, well, you know, that's one way you can do it. But there's a lot of different ways, and it depends on the person who's across from you. It depends on a whole lot of things which approach you're taking. And the calorie approach, you know, for me, I've always found it one semi-useful tool and something that I'll sort of apply. I for some people I'll apply or many people at a certain time I'll apply what I call relaxed tracking. And I'll say, I want you to just track 3 days for me just so I can get an idea of what eating looks like for you. And so you can get an idea of what your energy intake is. But if, you know, you don't even need to be that accurate. If you just track each meal for me, I can start to get a bit of a picture around what things are looking like for you. And maybe we'll track for, you know, every second day for a few weeks after that. But it's very far from this perfectionist model of tracking where you've got to be to the gram. It's just ballpark. And the thing I always say to them is, you know, if you're a female and you're looking to lose weight, if you're training daily and you're in a 2000 to 2500 range, yeah, you'll probably lose weight. You know, and that's a pretty easy range to live within, both from a compliance point of view and also an emotional bandwidth point of view, that you're not having to do it down to the fine detail.
Mm. What we would say to people who, to certain people who would disagree, depending on who it is awesome. Keep doing what you're doing. Mm. Keep doing exactly what you're doing. And if you're still stuck in 5 years' time and you've been continuously binge eating on and off the wagon, and now you've reached a point of threshold where you're super sick and tired of banging your head against a brick wall, cool, now we can have a conversation about something else that you might like to explore. Right now, you're clearly so emotionally invested in this being the one way, the right way. And I'd say the same thing to a coach. I'd say, look, if you believe that this is the only way of doing things and this is the best way of influencing behavior, right? That's the key thing, right? Not influencing science, right? Influencing behavior. How do you get a 35-year-old female corporate exec with 2 children at home into the best shape of her life and to stay in shape year round? If you are trying to get her to count calories and she's just not getting the results that she wants, and all you're saying is, clearly you don't want it enough, and then all of your clients are struggling with similar results and you can only get, you know, 5% of your clients to actually get a transformation, well, maybe now it's time to explore something different. If you've got 100% success rate and not just temporary, like 12-week transformation, this is another problem with the fitness industry, is that people can hide behind temporary transformations.
Yeah.
And then you don't see the monumental rebound that comes afterwards because the person's learned to hate the process. Right? Look into operant conditioning, which is negative reinforcement and positive reinforcement. You've conditioned your clients to hate the process because they have learned the only way that they can ever influence their body to lose weight, to lose body fat, is through a process that is highly stressful, highly perfectionist, all or nothing, and they've just learned to hate the process. So, again, if you've got 100% success rate and these are transformations that last year, amazing, keep doing what you're doing, that's awesome. But if you're starting to kind of really struggle with your clients, why are my clients not changing? And it works on paper and it works in science, but why is it not working in reality? Okay, well, maybe now, you know, and that's not to say that everything that you've learned so far is irrelevant and should be negated. No, like as a coach, you should have a much deeper understanding than your clients do, right? Your client doesn't need to know about how the mitochondria function. And I'd argue that probably most trainers don't either. Maybe you'd leave that for the functional medicine practitioners. But, you know, you do need a deeper level of understanding as to how these things work. And so that's great. Like, that's given you that foundation. Now let's go to the next level of being a coach, which is for how do we influence people's behavior more effectively?
Yeah, right. And influence more people. I mean, one of the things that jumps out at me there is the archetype of the trainer who will get really, really good results with those clients who can play this game or can play this game for a period of time. And then the people who aren't getting results, it's because they just, you know, they don't want it bad enough, or they're non-compliant, or, you know, they're saying they want one thing, but then their actions and their inability to track or keep records are showing me that they don't really want it. And so it's... I think, you know, that whole 50% science, 50% art, when we're looking at what makes a great coach, you're then going to see that person who has many tools to be able to help many people. They understand the nuance and they understand the gray between the black and the white of what we do.
Yeah. And you know, like exactly what you said, like, you know, tracking calories and your macros and you know, weighing your food, it's a great tool to be used, you know, periodically now and again, just to kind of see where you're at. And actually, you know, sometimes I don't do it now, but there have been times in the past when I was transitioning here where I would get people to, you know, if you don't know what, for example, 130 grams of chicken looks like, for argument's sake, and, you know, you want to look at like palm and a half of protein, like, and you want to like just weigh that once just to have a look at, like eyeball it, then that's completely fine. But, you know, when we're using a short-term tool to moderate long-term behavior, this is where we've got the problem.
It's a great educational tool.
It's a great educational tool. And that's it.
Yeah, tool, not all-encompassing method.
It's not irrelevant for everybody. Rachel still will have clients from time to time who she will get on calories and macros plans. Who would that be? MMA fighters who are getting into
a weight category.
Who are cutting weights, right? So if you've got an athlete who competes in the weight class, or if you've got a stage competitor. Right, and this is where a lot of the fitness industry has come from, right? Is, you know, stage competitions, bodybuilding, bikini competitions, and so forth. And somebody is peaking for not just the week, not just the day, but the hour that they are on stage. They are going for an extreme result that is completely unsustainable year round, because it's an extreme result. They're going to push the envelope as far as they possibly can for that 1 hour that they're on stage. And then obviously they're going to use very extreme methods. They're going to use things like carb cycling and calorie cycling and all of these things. And for somebody who's in that world, that's appropriate. Now, you know, I'd argue that there's very few people who can handle that emotionally.
Well, let's just like pull the cover back on this and like, let's just open up the dirty secret of the fitness industry. And I'm not saying that everybody, but there is a significant amount of bikini and figure competitors who really struggle with things like binge and emotional eating when they're off season. You know, they can be, you know, very on the wagon and dialed in when they're, you know, prepping for a show, et cetera, et cetera. The first time they prep, the second time they prep, you know, that's fine. That comes to the third time they prep and the cracks start to show where they're unable to, you know, stick to their meal plans. They're having a nibble of this, nibble of that, despite the fact that they got their show coming up. You know, reverse dieting then completely goes out of the window, because what is reverse dieting? It starts with a fucking tub of ice cream, a pizza, and, you know, a burger binge immediately after, on the night that you've competed, because you're just so desperate to get these foods in that you've been you know, not allowing yourself over this time. And this is definitely a pattern that we see. We have a lot of former bikini and figure competitors come through, you know, Chase Life because of these kind of patterns of control around that they've had around food.
Yeah.
More common than anybody wishes to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah. If a physique, like a bikini or physique competition, is not the solution to your eating disorder.
No, and you were like, you say that, like, say that again, please. Like, a bikini competition is not the solution to your disordered eating and your disordered relationship with food. And so many people think it is. When I have to have this bikini competition coming up in the future, or this figure comp, because that's the only way I know how to get into shape. When I get there, that's when I'm going to sort out my food issues afterwards. Honey, it's only going to make things 20 times worse.
Yeah.
Something related to that actually is like the mindset that when I get there, it's going to be easy to sustain it. It's kind of like they apply the methodology to, when I make $1 million, that $1 million is safe. I can put it into the bank. It's an investment and it's not going to go anywhere. And that money can just keep, like, it's almost like that. And it's like, well, when I get myself, you know, ripped and shredded, and I'm so shredded that I don't have a menstrual cycle anymore, because that's healthy. And, you know, but when I achieve this, like, impossible, like,
godlike physique,
yeah, then once I'm there, I can dot dot dot. And it's like, it's bonkers when you think about it. It's like they're chasing this like extreme result with extreme methods, and they think that when they get there, then they can then just kind of take their foot off the gas, and it's like it's going to sustain itself. And they've got no idea how to do life, basically.
Yeah, it's something I really feel the urge to sort of jump in on and say, like, this is not a judgment either. Like, we've all watched this over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. You watch people. What's that?
We've all made our own mistakes in life.
Oh, yeah. But if you've been in fitness, you've watched this. You've watched this story so many times, especially with the young girls who are coming into the gym at 18, and next thing they're doing their comp, and it's like, if you're doing a comp that young, I know what's been going on in recent years, and it's battles with food. And it's the same for guys. You know, a lot of these guys, I've talked about this before as well, a lot of these guys are coming into the gym to make to build the armor, to make up for their emotional shortfalls. You know, people are getting their needs met in the gym in all kinds of weird ways. And it's a fuel source that's going to eat up a lot of bandwidth, or that energy is going to eat up a lot of bandwidth, and it's very hard to sustain, that's for sure.
And I think, you know, I've had this conversation with a couple of people before about if our outcomes were 100% exclusively health, well-being and longevity, we'd probably do something along the lines of very moderate cardio, some moderate intensity calisthenics, bodyweight stuff, nothing strenuous, like nothing like really intense. Probably something along the lines of like yoga, Pilates, kind of mobility stuff. And we'd have, you know, somewhat throw nutrition to one side for a second, but, you know, some kind of healthy, balanced diet, right? And, you know, we have to remind ourselves that, you know, what is currently labeled as the fitness industry is not actually the aesthetics industry. And when somebody is more and more and more and more concerned about their aesthetics, not that, you know, aesthetics is a bad thing, not, you know, we all have to recognize that all of us want to look our best in some way, right? Otherwise you'd never get your hair done, you know, makeup, nails, handbag, and for guys, buy new clothes, you know, shave, get your hair done, whatever, right? Otherwise, we'd just all, quote unquote, let ourselves go and live in, you know, hemp clothes.
So, a little bit of vanity is okay.
Yeah, like there's nothing wrong with wanting to look your best. It's just, is it healthy and sustainable? And is it at a place where it's having a negative impact on your life? And like you said, like so many people are chasing aesthetics because they're seeking to fill emotional voids that could just never be filled with that. Some people do it with their work, right? They're addicted to their work. They get all of their sense of self-worth and significance from being busy. Mm-hmm. Some people, it's from their appearance. And, you know, again, like there's nothing wrong with chasing external goals because that adds value to your life. But if you're chasing these things as a way to full circle back to being able to accept yourself and who you are as a person, then it's never going to work because it's not true self-worth.
And a lot of this, I feel, comes down to keeping up with society and doing what you think society expects of you. Like the number of ladies that we interview for Chase Life who... I can tell you for sure, have spent a lot of money on Botox, on filler, designer clothes, handbags, hair extensions. Let me tell you how much this costs, right? You're looking at no less than $1,000 a month, $1,000 US a month to maintain all of this stuff, minimum. And yet, some of these ladies are really struggling emotionally, whether it's with chronic anxiety, serious eating disorders or disordered relationships with food, chronic issues with self-worth. And yet they can find the funds to do Botox, filler, hair extensions, et cetera, to keep up with their appearances in society. And yet they're not prepared to really invest in themselves to make themselves truly happy at a core level. Now, look, I bleach my hair. I have lash extensions. You know, I know what this stuff costs, right? And so this is where it's really important, I think, for women. Like, I was going to write this post, and I will eventually, but I'm going to call it, like, girl, wash your face. Like, as a woman, like, step up, hold a mirror in front of you. And you know what? If, like, you're spending and you're throwing all of this cash on the way that you look, yet you're fundamentally unhappy at your core, take a look at your finances. Like, let's just, like, re-divert that somewhere else. The amount of women and men, like, the amount of population that is in serious debt right now because they're trying to keep up with appearances. Like, we live in Dubai, right? Everybody here is driving, not everybody, but a lot of people driving around in cars that are too expensive. Everybody's got a Range Rover, Lamborghini, G-Wagon, et cetera, et cetera. Probably most of it is on finance, actually. And, you know, this is just a reflection of everywhere else in the world as well. So I think, you know, this does definitely go beyond that of just the fitness industry. It goes beyond aesthetics. It goes to a much deeper level, and that's, you have to invest in yourself first.
Yeah, because I mean, it's really good to do what fulfills you, but once you're doing things because you care too much about what others think, or you're doing things because you worry about what others think, as soon as that comes up in a conversation with me and someone's starting to behave or consider a behavior along those lines, I say to them, hey, you know what the secret is here? No one gives a shit.
Yeah.
Like, no one actually fucking cares. No one cares about all these things that you're preoccupied with worrying about. You know, no one else actually cares.
Yeah. Well, one of the things with addiction is that you can never get enough of something that almost works, right? You're chasing this physical appearance. You're chasing this status in society with money, accolades, whatever. And it almost makes you feel worthy. It almost makes you feel like you're enough as a human being. It's almost self-worth, but it's not. And so because it's not, it gives you a temporary hit. Gives you a temporary emotional hit that then dissipates afterwards. And that dissipation then happens faster and faster. So then you need it even more and more and more and more. And then you're into that addiction cycle, which you just can't stop. Because you're fundamentally trying to achieve self-acceptance through this external vehicle, which is never going to work.
Yeah, it's a really good way to describe it. What's the disconnect here? Why is it that so few people in the fitness industry have the real tools to help people with the game beyond the game?
I think it's just the next evolution, really. If you go back far enough in the fitness industry, you know, there was, well, there's been different phases that it's gone through, right? And that, you know, perhaps there was like the era of the perhaps the bodybuilders in the 80s, and then there was, like, I don't know, aerobics that came on the scene, and then there was personal training for a while, but personal training just was just horrendously poor standards. And you know, despite all of his flaws, one of the people who massively transformed that and took it to another level was Charles Poliquin, right? And you know, some people love him, some people hate him, but you cannot negate the impact he had. He forced people to learn about anatomy and to learn about some of the science, etc. And then you know, came the, you know, the evidence-based crowd and so forth. And so it's just been on this evolution. I think in society as a whole, the more economic and social stability we have, the more luxury we have to explore some of these things, right? You know, we go back to, you know, middle of the last century, and it's like post-war, like, our primary concerns were just putting food on the table, right? You didn't have the luxury to worry about, do I have abs? But now, you know, the more technology's come along, technology has taken more and more effort off our plate. Right, you know, even just with supermarkets, right, you don't have to go around a collection of whole different, you don't have to go to the baker and then go down to the other end of the town to, you know, the grocer and so forth. So more and more and more convenience in our lives means that we have more and more time and more luxury. So now we're in a place with the fitness industry, I think, where we have the luxury to be able to be diving more and more in detail as to what is truly going to work, what's going to make people happy and fulfilled and get them the results that they're after. And I think this is just the next evolution. We've been through the science. I kind of feel like, not that science is ever done, there's always new things to discover, but I kind of feel like science has gotten to a point where we know it. We know enough. We know enough about what works, what doesn't work scientifically in terms of nutrition and exercise science and so forth. And now it's a case of, how do we change behavior? How do we get people behaviorally to do what they want to do, what they say they're going to do, that's going to make them happy and fulfilled and give them the results that they want? I just think that's the next evolution now.
Yeah.
The truth is as well, is that it does take a highly skilled coach in order to be able to facilitate that type of change. Sure, you can get like small changes here and there. And I think personal trainers can actually, personal trainers, you're on the forefront, can do such amazing things with clients. But, you know, when we're talking about more serious things such as binge and emotional eating, you know, stress and overwhelm, anxiety, depression, as David works in, you know, all of these kind of things, it does take a highly skilled coach. Because one of the worst things that people can do, and you know, people often ask us quite a lot, can you just give us a few tips on how to address and overcome binge and emotional eating? And it's like, well, honey, there are actually no tips, because the problem is that if we give you one or two things in isolation, they will never fix your problem. And you, this is where the perpetual cycle is of, I've tried that and it doesn't work. Well, of course it doesn't work, because you haven't been given the full solution. And so there are no tips to overcome binge and emotional eating. Let me give you the biggest tip. Start investing in yourself and do the work and be ready to do a lot of work on yourself. Like, those are the biggest tips that I can give you, because it's not as simple as, you know, and we're conditioned nowadays into convenience and quick fixes and all of that kind of stuff. There isn't one. Yeah. If you want to change your life, you've got to go all in. And it's hard work, but it's so rewarding. And one of the things that I've talked about a lot is that I like it better when it's hard, because for me, I love discipline, and discipline is something that drives me and also gives me freedom. I think Jocko Willink talks about this, actually. Was it him that talks about discipline? Discipline equals freedom. And it's the discipline of showing up every day, even when you don't want to in training. It's the discipline of cooking a meal after you've had a long day. And you have to be, you know, David talks about being emotionally rewarded for these things. Well, I'm emotionally rewarded perhaps in a different way to other people are. You know, if I've had a long day at work and with the kids, and then, you know, I cook myself a healthy dinner, I get emotionally rewarded with the discipline and the pride that comes with that, because I know not everybody can do it. So what motivates me is going to be different to what motivates somebody else. But I do think that that's the missing thing, is that, you know, there are no tips and tricks. If you've got a problem and you want to fix it in its entirety, you got to go all in on it and know that it's going to take some work. And you know what? It's so fun. Like, when you get the right coach and you get the right method and you get the right, and the solution is there, it's such a fun and a liberating process. Like, God, like, you know, I struggled for so many years going through, you know, my transformation in terms of like overcoming stress and overwhelm, where, you know, I talk about the stories of, you know, having like monks try and teach me meditation, but I was still stressed. You know, I went to see a shaman and he was banging a drum around my head, asking me what my spirit animal guide was. Like, you know, I was still stressed. my spirit animal guide is definitely not a spider. But, you know, these tools, they're great, but I fundamentally didn't change who I was as a person, and I didn't change my identity. It's only when I really started getting into all of this that change happens, and it happens fast. It doesn't have to take a long time. I think there are these, you know, preconceived ideas of, oh, you know, it takes a long time to shift your identity. No, it doesn't. It happens in a heartbeat. It happens with a decision, and it happens with massive action every single day. Yeah. And so, you know, if you're listening to this and you're struggling with something in your life, address it. Stop complaining about it. Like, you've got to address these things head on.
Yeah, as long as you're complaining or feeling, you know, self-pity, it's very hard to fix it, isn't it? Now, you talked there about doing the work. If someone comes and works with you guys, what does the work look like? What sort of stuff are they going to be doing?
So in terms of fixing binge and emotional eating, so I'm sure you've heard lots of times that issues with food at the end of the day are nothing to do with food. That's just a symptom of deeper stuff that's going on. And yes, that's true, but we still need to address food. Why? Because people don't know how to achieve the goals that they want, but in a way that works with their psychology instead of against it. And so that's one of the things that we will address. But honestly, food is pretty straightforward. Most of the rest of it is all of the deeper mindset work and emotion work. So big picture, when it comes to resolving binge and emotional eating, there's two pieces of the puzzle, if you like. So the first is just rewiring the habitual responses around food, because most people, unfortunately, are making the issue worse, not better, without even realizing it. And you know, people often talk about willpower. Oh, it's all willpower. Well, willpower actually makes it worse. And so we need to teach people how to respond when urges and cravings are going to come up, because they are, and they're going to continue to come up in the short term until we resolve the problem. It's not something that we can just fix in one fell swoop like that. So we need to teach you how to respond when urges and cravings come up in a way that doesn't make it worse, but actually enables it to dissipate and then disappear. So we need to teach you how to kind of rewire the way that the habit gets stored unconsciously. So that's the first side of things. And then the second side of things is all of the underlying emotional blockages that are kind of standing in the way. So a lot of what we've talked about today, so overcoming things like perfectionism and people pleasing and overanalyzing and, you know, chronic stress and overwhelm and so forth, which fundamentally at its core is all a conversation about learning emotional fitness. It's about learning to regulate your emotions internally. One of the things I often say to people is learning how to live your life from the inside out. Most people feel like or believe that positive feelings or emotions are about fixing everything in the outside world. And I'm not saying that you should ignore the outside world. I'm not saying that you should just, you know, withdraw from life or go and live in a cave, which is some people's kind of approach to spirituality. It's like, I can only be spiritual by, you know, meditating in a cave for 10 years. It's like, well, what about being spiritual during daily life? Anyway, but it's about learning to regulate your emotional state internally, independently of what's going on around you, right? Because most people's emotions are constantly up and down based on whether the to-do list gets done or whether it doesn't, or whether there's some kind of interruption or there isn't, or, you know, there's some kind of conversation where they get criticized or blah, blah, blah. And so their emotions are being pushed and pulled around by life and circumstance and other people. It's like they've got this control panel on their chest that's available for everybody to push their emotional buttons, and they just don't have any emotional stability at their core. And that's why inevitably it's going to pop out in symptoms like binge eating and emotional eating, alcohol, food, drugs, shopping, gambling, social media, Netflix, or all of the above, right? Mm. So yeah, we need to teach people how to regulate their emotional state from the inside. So that's those are kind of big pieces, the things that we address within Chase Life. So yeah, it's when people kind of reach out for help, they often don't realize the extent to which there's or the depth with which we have to work, the level that we work at, and also the impact this is having on every other area of their life, right? That's why they're spending money needlessly and unnecessarily every single month on just meaningless crap that they don't need. That's why they're never fully present with their kids, and they're constantly distracted inside their mind, or their spouse is just getting the low energy, irritable version of them. When they're at work, they can't get the promotion, or they can't progress their career, or they can't get a new job because they don't have the confidence, they don't back themselves. Or they go the other way, which is they become the human doing, and they get all of their self-worth and their kind of self-acceptance from being a human doing, from being busy, constantly stressed, never being able to switch off. So it's affecting literally everything, their career, their finances, their relationship with their kids, themselves. And then they say, "Ah, I don't have time, now's not the right time."
Yeah.
So, well, none of that's ever going to change. change until you resolve these issues. The whole reason why you have no time, why you're chronically stressed, is because of this same problem. So yeah, it's all tied into literally everything that they do. So yeah.
So these people are coming to you for the solution to their binge eating, and they're getting the solution to all the other problems as well. They're getting the bonus plan.
It's basically a make you happy program packaged up as a fix your binge eating program.
Yeah.
And we get that result as well, right? We fix your binge eating, but we just end up fixing the things that really need fixing.
Ironically, it's such behind a, it. Yeah, ironically, people come to us to overcome binge and emotional eating or stress and overwhelm or, you know, whatever their big problem is. But it's such a small part of what we do. And it's funny because, you know, lots of ladies very kindly do testimonials for us, and they never mention binge and emotional eating in the testimonial. And like, you know, we'll call them on it and say, hey, you didn't mention binge and emotional eating. And it's such an afterthought. It's like, oh yes, I forgot I actually came into the program for that one thing, but it's so irrelevant now because I've got all of this out of it instead, which is awesome. But yeah, it is essentially, you know, we teach people how to be happy.
Yeah, I mean, we've covered some great ground in this episode, and I think in wrapping it up, you've kind of answered my last question. I was going to say, you know, what does life look like for someone who's traditionally struggled with all this? They do the work and then they turn the corner. What's the contrast and what's the difference?
That's I love that question, actually, because quite often people say stuff like, I can't imagine what my life would be like without this problem. Or I can't imagine who I would be without this problem. And if that's the case, there's nothing sinister going on, but the brain favors the path of least resistance. So whenever it thinks about a certain topic, whether it's your body or your future or whatever, then it's going to create the images and the thoughts and the ideas that are just the freshest, that are just the most easily accessible. Well, which ones are those? Just the ones you've reinforced a lot. So what inadvertently people end up doing is they take memories from the past and then project them into the future, and then they wonder why history keeps repeating itself. And so in truth, we actually need to start defining and designing what the outcome is at the end of the process. What does your life look like at the end of that? Well, now that you have all of this emotional freedom around food, and you're no longer struggling with negative body image, and you no longer struggle with a relationship with yourself, that is going to free up so much time, so much effort, so much mental capacity. You're going to, in terms of the things that perhaps won't change, right? Because for, generally speaking, there's people that fall into two camps. One is where the externals wouldn't change that much. It's like, I'm still going to do the same job, see the same people, do the same things with my time, but my internal experience is completely transformed. Now I'm fully present with my kids. I actually feel a true sense of inner peace. I love myself now, not from a narcissistic point of view, but just, you know, I have that great connection with myself. I have so much more confidence, etc., etc. And so now I'm, you know, when I'm at work, I'm no longer second guessing. Like, instead of all of that, like, oh my God, did I say the right thing? And did that, what people think? Like, think that I was being stupid there, or that, you know, what if they don't like me because I disagreed with them? Blah, 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 all of that, like, second guessing everything that's going on. Now they're just being themselves. They're just focused on outcomes. They make a decision and move on. And so now there's no longer decision fatigue. They've got additional energy left over at the end of the day to spend with their kids and so forth. Whereas for other people, they have that, but there's also a whole bunch of other stuff externally that's going to change because they've been holding back in life. They'd love to get the promotion, or they'd love to just change their career, but they've never actually backed themselves. Or they, you know, they get out dating for the first time, and they've been avoiding dating because they don't feel good enough. Or they get out of a destructive relationship because they've never had the confidence to do so. Or they don't think, you know, they think, what if this is the best that I can get, and I just have to settle for this, and so forth. So for some people, like, there's changes in relationships or in their career, or they launch that business they always wanted to launch, or they finally start marketing their business online properly instead of, like, all of this perfectionism and fear of rejection and so forth. And so for some people it's primarily the internals, but for other people it's kind of both the internals and the externals. But yeah, it's about, well, what does your life look like on the in the absence of this problem? And it's interesting when you ask people, what do you want? And quite often it's all of their language is about negation. It's like, I'm not struggling with this, and I have freedom, which is basically I'm free from something, right? I'm free from the stress, I'm free from the overwhelm, I'm free from the obsessive thoughts about food. Okay, well, if that's gone, that's removed.
What have you got?
Yeah.
What are you with? what are you feeling instead? And to start getting clarity on the vision of what is the outcome at the end of the process. And when you have clarity on that, that's when you get excited, and you know, that's when you can actually start creating.
Amazing. Amazing. Must be fulfilling watching people go through this.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It is awesome. And you know, the best thing, like, I think it's even better when, you know, our ladies contact us 2, 3, 4, 5 years later. You know, we had ladies who we worked at the end of 2015 who were just still crushing it. And like, that is the best, you know. It's like having, it's like, you know, it's the equivalent of, like, you know, when you're a personal trainer and you teach somebody how to eat properly and how to exercise properly. And, you know, I've got clients in Sydney who I coached 10 years ago, and they're still messaging me saying, hey, Rach, I did this thing that you taught me how to do. You know, it gives you a sense of pride, and not only a sense of pride for yourself, but you're so proud of that client for doing the work, because it does take work and it takes commitment, because, you know, this stuff can be really hard sometimes, you know, when you don't want to do this, and it's in those moments that you don't want to do the thing that you've got to do it. So yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. It's a good feeling when you can watch someone from afar and you just see they get it now. And, yeah. And you know, that was cause, you know, you planted a seed, or you showed them how to do it, or you just introduced them to a concept or a way of thinking that takes all that struggle out of it. And this is one of the areas I think a lot that there is a disconnect. A lot of personal trainers just find this stuff easy. They find the fitness and food thing easy. Not all of them, but a lot do. And so the real challenge can be, you know, how do I show someone else how to do it easy? You know, how do I show them how to do this without it being this big struggle? How do I, you know, communicate this point of view to them that if they want a transformation, you know, if they want to transform their physique, sometimes a sleep in is better than getting up and training. How do I give them the context for nuance around, you know, you got to work out, but it doesn't have to be this all-encompassing masochistic quest for burning every last fat cell off until you're 0% body fat. It can be an effortless thing once you get your head around what it actually looks like.
Yeah. And I think that ultimately comes down to the trainer's motivation for helping people. Because a lot of people get into the fitness industry because they love fitness for themselves, which is great. But some trainers are on the gym floor and they're just going through the motions, they're counting reps, they're leaning on the nearby piece of equipment, and they look bored out of their mind when they're with their client, and then their own training session comes around and they're like pumped and they're excited and they're high-fiving everybody. It's like, dude, like, you clearly don't care that much about your clients. And so, not that there's anything wrong with that, but maybe you're just in the wrong industry. So I think, you know, if you want to be a trainer or anybody who's in the service industry where you're helping other people, whether it's, you know, more on the mindset side like what we do, or as a trainer or as a physiotherapist or any kind of service-based industry like that, you have to genuinely give a shit.
Yeah.
And if you do, then you'll figure out the answers to what you were just asking about. Well, how do I, you know, how do I translate? It's easy for me. It's not for this client. How do I figure out how to make it easy for that client? If you genuinely give a shit, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, totally. Totally. We've covered some great ground today, and it's baby bath time in the Lowry house. So let's wrap it up. I'm sure there's going to be people who listen to this episode who are really keen to learn more about what you guys do. So where can they find you on the socials?
Well, I'm Athletic Fox and David is DX Godfrey on Instagram. Instagram is kind of where we usually hang out now. We still have Facebook as well. David's page is facebook.com/david.godfrey.page. And mine is facebook.com/RachelGuyFitPro. Haven't updated that since we got married, actually, so I should probably update my name. But the best place to find out a little bit more about what we do is our website, which is chaselifeconsulting.com.
Awesome. All right, guys, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an illuminating chat, and we've delved into some territory here that's a little bit off the beaten track, and we'll give a lot more depth to the game beyond the game. So I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure everyone else will as they listen in.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks for having us.
No worries, guys.